Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Gary Hour. We're continuing our theme of formative experiences, and this episode I talked to comedian Justin Williams. Pretty crazy stuff, you'll hear about it, but growing up in several different hotels, being shuffled around, going from inner city to the suburbs, all kinds of things you're going to hear about. It's a pretty wild ride, and I'm happy that he was open enough to share this kind of stuff with you. So I hope you enjoy, and as usual, this episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of apps for content creation. Check them out on the App Store. Just go to Future Moments, and you'll see all kinds of apps, whether you need a video that sounds good, you need to record a podcast, you need to master your podcast so it sounds good, like this one. Check out Future Moments on the App Store. Thanks a lot. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and I hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope you get something out of it. I know I did.
What I like to do is really soak it all in.
Nice, yeah. So it says on your bio that you consider yourself black.
Yeah.
And comfortably middle class.
Yeah. That was the title of like the first long stand-up set I ever filmed.
Black and comfortably middle class.
Yeah, so I put the cover was me with like a Thomas Jefferson shirt on.
Cool.
Yeah, it was like the idea of like doing something that people, you know, turning it on its head, so that people weren't used to seeing. Then like in the 4 or 5 years since I've done that, that's basically every comic that's like famous as a black comic now. That's like
that's comfortably middle class.
Yeah, we're like in an explosion of like black middle class voices.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, like everybody is like, I'm black, but here's my take on consumerism.
Right.
It's like it's like everybody now, you know.
Is that progress?
Yeah, it's better than being confined to, you know, just a certain type of room or people expecting you to only talk about a certain type of thing. It's just funny now. It's like you got to go back the other way now. You know what I mean?
Do you feel that way as a black comic that you're supposed to talk about a certain thing?
Well, you know, comedy segregated. There's all kinds of scenes, you know what I mean? So there's an urban comedy scene where like, you know, only like one or two white comics even know about where the rooms are, or yeah, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, subject matter in those rooms are a little bit different than what you'll see maybe in Times Square or something like that. And in a lot of neighborhoods now, especially with gentrification, you might have an urban room actually running. You could have two shows in the same neighborhood. Like I run a show in downtown Newark. My show is very different than maybe a show that could literally be like right down the street.
Is your show considered urban?
No, not really. I mean, we have urban comics on the show, but it's a mix of comics. So like the way you can always judge anything, like if I'm ever doing a show, like an urban show, if I'm like up in the Bronx or if I'm up in Harlem or something like that, or if I'm like deep in Newark or something like that, I always know it's an urban show if my name is the only government name on the flyer.
Justin Williams. Yeah, it's very, you know, proletariat or something.
Yeah, no, it's like, yeah, I don't have a stage name. So a lot of black comics that work all black rooms actually have stage names.
Right, right. And for non-comedy listeners, we should say that calling in an urban room, it sounds so segregational something.
Yeah, because they're all in a city. All these shows are in the context of the city. Urban room just means like in like the black neighborhood that like caters to a predominantly black audience.
Right. And yeah. I've done a couple that are considered urban rooms, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And it is a different experience.
It's different. It's different. Like there's certain things that I'll do in those rooms that you change because it's more about the nature of your performance in those rooms. It's about being a performer.
Yeah.
Rather than like the strength necessarily of your writing per se.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's interesting because I'm curious to hear your experience doing an urban room compared to maybe an alternative room, which is probably more white.
Yeah, the alternative. Well, so it's weird. I mean, because it's like, yeah, some of these alternatives are on black, but there's also like black alt rooms too. That's the thing. Like a black alt room is not the same as an urban show even. Those are two different shows even.
Cool.
Like a black urban room is like a Jill Scott concert. There's like a lot of Whole Foods bags, but there's dreadlocks.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, there's that. And then
Michael Franti's hanging out in the back.
Yeah. And then there's like an urban show. Urban show is just a little bit different, right? It's like, you know, there's, there's a DJ. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's going on, and like comics are working the DJ as part of their bits, and like, you know, the show just might turn into a snap session. You know what I mean?
What's a snap session?
Just like, oh, look at this dude, or did you see how bad that other comic bombed? We're going to talk about that for the next hour and a half, and just really, you know, like it's the format's a little different. It's not like you're not going up there like, oh, well, I read in the paper,
right?
Yeah.
So you would describe it the differences as it's much more. Critical?
I'm not gonna say critical, but if I had a choice of where to bomb in comedy, it's not gonna be at that urban show.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you probably have a different experience being a black person doing an urban room.
Oh, that's
no, than but, I do being a white person doing an urban room. I find it actually pretty fun. I haven't bombed yet, so maybe that's why I think that, but I find it pretty fun because it's a lot more lively and interactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that.
It's actually better, from my observation, it's actually better. This is going to sound counterintuitive, but it's actually better to be a white comic in that room. Because the audience is just, number one, your viewpoint is just never represented on those shows.
Right.
So the audience is like, oh, this is cool, like actually in a way. So it's like, there's not the same expectation. As a black comic, if you bomb on that room, it's like, I mean, it's just merciless.
Right.
Like, I'm not saying it's good to be a white comic that bombs either. It could go either way depending.
Yeah.
But I'll say that like, I notice there's a weird thing, like our urban audiences I find are usually generally pretty nice to like the one white comic on the show. You know,
interesting.
Like, because it's like, oh, you're expected to have a different point of view to where you can have a different point of view as a black comic on an urban show, but you have to be a force of nature in order to get that audience to buy into it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're probably looking at you with arms crossed a little more.
Yeah, because they're like, what is, you know, it's like, it, depending on if you come up there. And there's also, I mean, if you look at black performers in that room, there's a projection of confidence.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know what I'm talking about. If you want to look at acts like Michael Blackson or Mike Epps, mm-hmm. or, you know, like Talent or Imagine or Capone or any of these people, there is no lack of confidence in that presentation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you come up there and you work a certain style, you know, you have to really go up there and own the room or you can lose control of it, which is why I really like those rooms.
Yeah.
Because it's the only time where I'm ever like, you know, you get lazy sometimes in certain comedy scenes.
Uh-huh.
And those I'm always like, this is actually like my fight or flight
keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, I'm like, I have to do well because you just have to leave. There's nothing more embarrassing. No, what do you think, you're gonna bomb and then go hang out?
No, you have a cloud of stink around you that you have to immediately leave the building.
I mean, because the post-bombing commentary,
mm-hmm.
is even worse. Like, the things that people might say to console you will hurt your feelings even more.
What did you call it before? A snap?
Yeah, like a snap session.
Oh, snap, that was shit. Oh, snap, that was...
Or just look at his shoes, or look at it, you know, or did you see, like, I mean, there's a great club in Atlanta that I've never performed at that I want to at some point. It's called Uptown Comedy Club.
Uh-huh.
And there's just, you know, it's like video of a guy bombing, And the host just comes up and does 40 minutes on the guy bombing.
Oh, no.
And like, did you see the moment when the confidence left his eyes? And it's like, you know what I mean? Like, you see how he put his head down? You know
totally,
what I mean? And it's just like, yeah, it's like, I mean.
So you get roasted. Not only do you bomb, but then you get roasted.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So like, I like doing those shows when the, you know, especially when the, you know, conditions are conducive, because you know you're funny. And the audience, in the way that if you bomb is bad, if you kill, like, you feel, like, incredible.
Right.
You feel like you, you know, but it's also, you know, it's, like, keeps you honest, you know what I mean? Because now, I think you get, a lot of comedians can insulate themselves now with the sub-marketing. Like, if I wanted to only perform for just woke, middle-class black people, there's actually an audience for that now.
Yeah.
And I could avoid that scenario entirely. But I think it's good to put yourself in a position to where, like, I perform for, like, Trump supporters sometimes out on the road, you know what I mean?
And how do you do with that?
I do well, man. You know, it depends on the degree of the Trump supporter. There's some that just, you know, hate you.
Yeah. Because your material can be political.
Yeah. A lot of it. Yeah. But
and you're not pro Trump.
No.
We should be clear about that.
No, man. Yeah, I'm not Ben Carson.
So do you find that they're on board with you? Aren't they, even if the joke is funny, if you're anti-Trump, they're just not on board usually?
Well, I don't know. It's been a weird time, cuz the key is writing a joke that's so funny you can get them to laugh at it. Like, if you can make fun of Trump and get a Trump supporter to laugh at it, that's like, oh, that's actually a good joke, you know what I mean?
Because
anybody can be like, well, Trump sucks, and then get an applause from people they agree with. But if you can make a Trump supporter laugh at Trump, it's like oh, that's a good joke, because they're like, oh, I can't even deny that that's untrue what you're saying.
Yeah.
The bad issue is that Trump does things that make it so much to where it's like, you feel like an accomplice to a crime, because Trump is so bad that if you're even attempting to sort of like rationalize this guy in any way, you're like, am I like an accessory to the things he does? That's the thing that's bad about Trump, actually. He's so bad you can't even, it becomes hard to actually approach making fun of him in good faith.
Right. How do you know it's a Trump supporting room?
Based on the geography of where I'm at, I can tell based on what you're wearing. I'm from the Midwest, so I'm used to...
You're from Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah, which is like a broad... It's directly in the middle of the country, so you get to see a broad cross-section of people.
Uh-huh.
So I can tell based on the way you look a lot of times, based on where you live. I can tell all those things, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a skill, and we're wrong quite a bit, but you get that skill from being a stand-up comedian on stage.
Yeah.
I've gotten to the point where I can kind of pick out who's in a relationship and who's single.
Yeah.
Is there something about their aura or something? It's interesting.
Well, even in the way that they approach a comedy show is like where they sit, like how they're sitting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I can get ideas like yeah. Okay. So the best story I could tell, I was just in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and it was the greatest thing, because I could tell who was who. Right? It's like, you know, guy with kind of Hulk Hogan handlebar mustache, white hair,
yeah,
kind of leather jacket with his wife that he probably calls his old lady, arms crossed
while you're on stage,
doesn't crack a smile
right
the entire time. And then there's like two lesbians sitting next to him having the time of their life, and it's like you can tell who's who in the room. You know, like, so yeah, like there's stuff like that, you know.
Yeah. Do you ever feel fearful for your safety?
I mean, this is the first time I've been doing comedy for like almost 10 years now.
Okay.
So, you know, it was the end of the Bush administration. It was like Obama and stuff like that. And when I've never seen people try to kill me until the Trump thing started coming along.
Right.
There were like two guys from like Arizona at a show in Caroline's, actually in New York, where it was like, I'm not leaving before they do.
Yeah. You were scared they're going to wait for you outside.
Yeah. It was that kind of, it was like, they just wouldn't tolerate. And that was also height of the campaign, but it was also a political themed show, which was so crazy, that's what sort of makes it crazy with the Trump supporters, is like I'll come to this, and then how dare you do what you do in the context where you said you were going to do it.
Right. They should know that it's New York. It's a political theme. It's comedy. Odds of being a comedian being pro Trump are pretty small.
Yeah.
In New York, at least.
Yeah. Well, and, you know,
Not that there aren't, because there are.
They're out there, man. They have their own lane, and their lane may not be mainstream show business, but there's rooms where they're crushing it right now.
That's an interesting way to think about it, your lane.
Yeah.
Have you found your lane?
I don't know. I just want my lane to be funny, but I think I should find a lane now. I've been thinking about that now, because the sub-marketing thing is what's happening now.
Yeah, sub-marketing, like your different, all the different niches that are available.
Yeah, so I think I should find that. Honestly, I think if I became a black Trump supporter, that could be like actually the big thing. I could be number one then.
You would be the first person in that lane.
I would be the number, if a black Trump supporting stand-up comedian, yeah. Dude, I would instantly be a millionaire. Are you kidding me? I'd sell out all over this country. I think about it all the time, but it's just like I just couldn't do it.
What about doing that in the form of like the way Stephen Colbert was conservative?
Yeah, okay. So I mean, I'm okay with making fun of the conservative elite. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like the way that Colbert does, but I'm not necessarily comfortable with
playing a character.
Yeah, that makes fun of like working class people. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I mean, especially the way it comes off, you know what I mean? And then also as part of that sort of ethos, it's like, we're not responsible for it, but it does. Me doing that thing, what that does is like delivers those people further to Trump.
You think?
It's like, I care. I'm anti-Trump enough.
Yeah.
To where I don't even want to do anti-Trumpism in that way because it helps Trump.
Right, so you're pushing, makes them push back more.
Yeah, it gives them what they want. It says, oh, this Northeastern black liberal elite
right.
is making fun of you. I'm not making fun of you. I understand you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, to where my act is more about, like, I understand you because I used to grow up around you. I'm just going to tell you why you're nuts, but I'm telling you why you're nuts on your own terms, not as an outsider.
Right.
I'm telling you, I understand what you're thinking, and you're making crazy choices right now, and we need to be able to laugh at this crazy choice that you've made.
Yeah.
Like, you've delivered us to a racist reality TV show host. And I know you don't like Hillary Clinton, but you cannot pretend this is normal.
Right.
You know,
I mean, that's a great thing about comedy. You could spoon feed the sugar with some humor.
Yeah. It's like, if I come out, I don't want to be, you know, it's like, I don't want to go out. I actually want to entertain the audience.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they paid money. I don't want to ruin somebody's night that, you know, came out and things like that.
First and foremost, you want to be funny, but you do. You do a lot of political stuff, so you're trying to
get a message across.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get a message across, like, because they're not used to seeing that point of view, especially if you're on the road. Like, my point of view is just not represented on stage. You know what I mean? Like, black comics that work out in the road, if they're working for, like, white audiences and stuff like that, you know, mm-hmm. they do, like, kind of like, you know, they're like black jokes, you know what I mean, for the white audiences, which is fine. But I'm not really about that. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to challenge you.
Well, I think that's refreshing, actually.
Yeah.
Do you find audiences are refreshed by the fact that you're not coming up there and talking about?
Maybe they might get it. I think a lot of people like it. They haven't seen it. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of show business is just doing something that people haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
And like, people are like, cool. That's cool. But at the same time, you know, maybe there's one or two people that's like, that's not what they expect you to say. So they don't like it, but that's okay.
Has anyone ever attacked you?
No one's ever attacked me. But people will come up and say funny stuff after shows and stuff like that. Like, they'll tell you who they voted for and stuff, like, after my show, which I think is interesting. Or they'll be like, this is why I did it, which I think is interesting, actually, because it's actually kind of, it becomes more of a conversation.
It also means that you got to them. They have to explain themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And also it means like they're making themselves into a human being, which is good because they come across as a caricature to us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they go, I did this because of this. And it's like, well, I may not agree with what you said, but I understand you. I understand your humanity a little mm-hmm. bit out of this interaction. So I hope you understand me. I understand you. And that's like, you know, the first step to actually having a functioning civil society.
Yes, and that's really what we're lacking and what we could use more of these days.
Yeah, it's horrible out there. It's as bad as I've ever... this is bad, you know what I mean? That's why I don't even, like, it's like, I'm wondering, like, I'm like, should I even be doing political comedy at this? I mean, I guess it's more necessary than ever, but it's so bad that some people, they can't even... Everybody wants to shut down. Even a lot of liberals, I've noticed, if like, I don't even want to hear about Trump. Like,
right.
Like, I'm just going to shut down.
But also, people are quick to make everyone a caricature and then already know everyone's stance, and then that's it.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, it's just kind of lazy, because then you're like, oh, that person's that. I've got them figured out. No more work for me to do on my end.
Yeah.
That's it.
And it's also empathy. It's like, I mean,
lack of.
Yeah. Well, it's like you go out to places, you know, and it's like, I mean, you see what deindustrialization has done, not just the cities.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. it's like, what are you going to come to? I'm going to come and like come to this town and then like that's having a tough time and then just give them a strong talking to. It's like, that's not what these people.
Right.
It's like Jesus. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a fine line, because ultimately I'm with you where I just feel like I'm an entertainer up there, and I want to, if people are paying for tickets and drinks, they're probably trying to escape their lives.
Yeah.
But then I also want to have some sort of message.
It's a weird mix, because the people are so nice. That's what, okay, this is what's weird about America, right? Is like that you have mm-hmm. this mean-spirited mass sort of political movement, right?
Yeah.
But then you go to these places, and the same lady that's, you know, probably, you know, doing something crazy, she's like, she will bake you a pie and show you to her, yeah, this is my husband, and yeah. here's all, and show you your family history. It's like the same lady.
Well, because you're face to face and you're seeing each other in 3D. It's not online. It's just some name on a screen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yelling at you in all caps.
Well, it's not somebody that's being energized. I mean, it's just, I mean, I think what it shows is, right, is that people are susceptible to messaging, which is in the same way, like, right, it's the same way some of these places like Obama, like, crushes in. But like Trump crushes in.
Right.
It's people
right.
that are just receptive to any sort of messaging.
Yeah.
Like whatever you put out there, they will give back.
Hope.
Yeah. Hope. Togetherness. They're like, that feels good. I'll do that. And then like just hatred and exclusion. They're like, we'll roll with that. You know what I mean?
Well, it's
like Ghostbusters too.
it's all like hope makes people feel empowered.
Yeah.
And Trump, I don't know if he's giving people hope. Maybe he's giving them a sense of empowerment through victimization. They're a victim of something.
Yeah.
And that's what Fox News really strives on. They're always playing the victim role. They're out to get Christmas. They're out to get you. They're out to get this.
Yeah, man. Fox News, man. I just watch them. At this point, it's gotten so ridiculous. It's like every time Trump does something that would be a career ender for any other politician.
Yeah.
I always just go to foxnews.com just to see which unflattering picture of Hillary Clinton they're running as the top story.
Instead of the real story.
Yeah, instead of the real story. Yeah, the real story is buried deep on their page. You know?
I mean, is it really still possible for people to watch Fox and consider it fair and balanced?
They're not doing it. I mean, it's just more comfortable to live in the world you live in. You know what I mean?
It's safe.
Because you see the same thing with memes online. I mean, conservatives rely on misinformation like a lot, right? Because just in order to pass their agenda, right? They just make stuff up. But then every once in a while, I see these liberal memes that are actually not completely accurate and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I'll bring it up to people. And actually, their justification, they won't even take it down, right?
Oh.
Their justification will actually be the same as a Trump supporter. It's like, well, it's good.
They're doing it.
They're doing it or something like that. I'm like, man, we're, you know.
Yeah, that's not good. Yeah. All right, let's talk about your formative experience. Was it when Trump got elected?
No, man.
I doubt it.
No. For my formative experience was actually going to different type of schools growing up. Like when I was in the Kansas City School District as it lost its accreditation. Like, and I think it's just now maybe getting ready to earn its accreditation back. Like,
what do you mean it lost its accreditation?
Like if you go to those schools, it like doesn't count basically.
This is elementary school?
No, the whole district.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was getting ready to go to high school. I was like in eighth grade.
Okay.
So I had to go to high school. I went from like inner city Kansas City out to the suburbs in Lee Summit, Missouri.
Okay.
And I was like in Missouri, the context of a suburb is like a place that was a farm town where a bunch of like people with money move. And so it actually becomes this contested atmosphere because there's like kids that are from originally what was a farm town. Then mm-hmm. there's kids in polo shirts with like Lexuses that are like moving and building giant houses in said farm town. Then there was like all the black kids that are trying to get an accredited education that follow them out there.
Oh.
So this formative moment for me was going to high school in this context that we didn't realize it at the time. Everybody's just in this place is changing in all these ways.
Right.
But it's like you're in a crazy tinderbox of a situation, mm-hmm. and you're like becoming a man in that situation, you know?
Yeah, it's a formative time in general.
Yeah, you know, and it's
eighth,
like
ninth grade.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you start driving, but then there's the suburban cops that are out there that are like black people are moving here in that particular moment, that place's history. Like that, it's funny, that place now has like a black population that's representative of like national averages. I think the superintendent of Lee Summit Schools is a black guy now.
Okay.
But back then when we first moved out there, they sent a letter home that called black students the challenging new demographic.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
So before eighth grade, you were going, you said you called it an inner city school?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Mostly black?
Yes. And like four, like there'd be like white kids were a novelty. Like, okay. There was like four white kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
like, did they do well in the school, like an urban room?
They did. Well, so that's what's so funny about it. Cause you, depending on what part of town you grew up on, like kids would take that personality. So there was a kid that went to, Grandview High School, which is kind of like a hood suburb. It's mm-hmm. like a predominantly black. It's like where white people with money lived 50 years ago, but then they fled even that
right.
place. And it's like all black and it's a white kid. And, he used to wear Steve Harvey suits and stuff like that to uh-huh. debate tournaments, and they used to call him like white chocolate. And he actually became, he went to Morehouse College
uh-huh.
and he became the first white student ever elected to the student council at Morehouse College in Atlanta.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's like his whole life, like just cause he grew up in Grandview, he just ends up like living the black experience as a white kid, you know?
Well, so was it a poor area?
Grandview? Where I was living in Kansas City
before eighth grade.
But it wasn't the worst. No, so it was like I didn't really consider myself poor, but you know in the 90s and stuff like that, like crack was like still around. Okay. You know what I mean?
And then in that area.
Yeah. Right. Like I mean there's like shootings like around. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're watching people get gunned down or anything like that, but you hear shootings.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You hear gunshots, you know what I mean?
Before eighth grade, you would hear gunshots.
Yeah, in the 90s in South KC, for sure. Like, yeah, it was like, you heard shooting every once in a while. Yeah.
Was that the time of drive-by shootings?
That was drive-by shootings. Yeah. It was like, so my high school, my neighborhood school would have been Southeast High School. That got closed down. That was one of the, it wasn't a good school in a bad district.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a very good school. But HBO... And not super far from where I was living, HBO did a documentary about one of the high schools in the Kansas City School District, and they were tracing gang members and crack dealers. And so guys my age, what HBO figured out was a guy my age, before, if he was in a gang or selling crack, he had an average of 6 months before he was dead or in jail.
Wow. This is about the early 90s, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
The drive-by shootings were kind of a thing then.
I think Kansas City was like the drive-by capital, like of like the region.
Okay.
So even today, like Kansas City's like a wonderful city. It's an insane place in the Philly that it's like this wonderful, great place to raise a family, and it sort of represents all these wholesome things, but it's routinely ranked as one of the most violent cities in America at the same time.
Is it, would you say it was when you were growing up pretty segregated?
So what makes Kansas City odd is that it's segregated, but it's segregated within its city limits. And it also has like interracial sharing of government power. So it's like white people don't live east of Troost in the city, but uh-huh. they don't mind having a black mayor. So like there's a multiracial sort of coalition, like people are segregated, but they are within the city limits. Now I live in Newark, New Jersey, where any city, Newark, Trenton, Patterson, Camden, all these places, there's no white people in any of the cities. Like all white people just completely left the cities.
Right.
That's actually worse. It's actually better to be segregated, but still be in the city limits and share them.
Yeah.
Than once because like once all white people leave the cities, they don't care what happens to them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They start making weird policies, like building highways around people's houses, and you know what I mean? That kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Bring the values way down.
Yeah, it becomes like, it becomes a dumping ground for whatever you don't want, right? Yeah.
So all of a sudden you're going into eighth grade or going into ninth grade.
Yeah.
And you have to move out of your school district into a totally different area.
Yeah.
And a totally different school.
Yeah.
With a totally different demographic.
Yeah, because the first year, my first year of high school, my parents actually put me in a Jesuit Catholic school, but it was like tremendously expensive. It was like going to like Notre Dame. And then plus, I think the urban Catholic schools, they can charge a lot because it's, you know, it's white people that have money.
Right.
That send their kids there. And I guess black people have money too, you know. So we couldn't afford that. So I ended up going to public school, yeah, and just moving completely.
And how long was the bus ride? They'd bus you out of the city, huh?
No, they weren't bussing us out. You had to move. You had to get an address because the suburbs have protected themselves. Yeah, you had to have an address. Yeah, you had to move. So we had to move.
You had to move. So all the kids in that area
had to move. Some may have had some fake addresses, but we actually lived there because I had an aunt and uncle that moved out there and like bought property in like 1989 when it was still like a one horse town. Now there's over like 100,000 people in that place.
Wow. Well, I mean, what else were they expecting? Right? If you have to move there to go to get your kids to school.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of that. You know, I mean, so Kansas City's like this huge metropolitan area, but it's also that Lee Summit is not, it actually kind of comes really close to, it's not that far out there. And it also has, it's like geographically, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's actually, for a suburb, it's actually a lot of land. I think it's like, geographically, I think it's like the third biggest place in Missouri.
Okay.
That's how big this suburb is randomly.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you moved there, did you feel like you had to change your personality to fit in?
No, I didn't have to really change anything. It was actually just acclimating myself and understanding more. It's like the most, like, high school was like the most I had ever learned about white people. Like, as far as like white people are different from each other. Like, there's different types of white people. Like, because you get a chance to see, like, a spectrum of whiteness in a place like that. Like, you get to see, like, a dude that plays golf and a dude in a Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirt.
Right. Yeah.
Or, you know, those are, like, your classmates.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then you get to see, like, you know, you get to see all kinds of things. It was, like, there was class and there was all this other stuff. There's, like, sex and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then, oh, there's also, I mean, a big, huge thing. It's, like, white people that are evangelical Christians and the ones that aren't. That was a huge divide in our high school, right? You know?
Definitely.
Yeah, you don't get a sense of any of that. If you're growing up in an all-black neighborhood, you're like, oh, all white people are just white people. It's like, no.
Right. So this is your first real experience with that.
I mean, I've been around white people before, but I didn't know. Like, there's, like, in high schools where you get to know them, like, intimately. You go to people's houses and you know, it's only time I'd ever been in a school system consistently enough. Like, all my oldest friends are actually high school friends.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, it's like those are the people that I actually know best. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You always had older friends?
No, I just moved around so much, you know, because instability between, like, my parents and stuff like that. So, we grew up, like, splitting time between Kansas City and Dallas, Texas, and then going to all kinds of, like, different schools, you know.
Sweet. So, your parents were divorced?
Yeah.
And then you'd be sometimes with your mom, sometimes with your dad?
Yeah. Yeah.
From Dallas, Texas?
Yeah.
To Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah. I mean, the context was kind of the same in Dallas because I was always just the, it's like what Chris Rock said, like, just like, I was like the poor person around white people.
Uh-huh.
That's the way it kind of was in Dallas.
Yeah.
So, but the schools, they had busing in those districts.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a contested atmosphere because it was like rich white people, but then like, you know, like North Dallas, like we had gangs when I was in school in Dallas. That was like a thing,
yeah.
You know, in junior high, you know what I mean? It was like there were like actual gang members. And it was like, if you're a black kid, you're sort of navigating, like, some of my friends come from gang territory and some of my friends are soccer players.
Right, exactly. Well, that's the strange nuance of the United States, I think. There's like different classes. You know, there's a poor neighborhood, then there's a wealthy neighborhood. And when I was growing up, there was race riots,
yeah,
but it wasn't necessarily people. There were kids that didn't figure it out, but it was really just a fight between the wealthy neighborhood and the poor neighborhood.
Yeah.
So there was all these people in between because you have the poor white kid maybe rocking out to some Lynyrd Skynyrd to harp on a stereotype.
Yeah.
He's poor also.
Yeah.
But that's the nuances, and people just see race because it's easier to see, but really a lot of times it's a class underneath it.
That's why it wasn't Lee Summit, man. It's like, you know, the real deal country boys, like, they did not like those suburban kids. Like, you've come out here, you've raised our cost of living, you've built gated communities in our town,
right?
You know what I mean? Like, and that was just like, I mean, that was eye-opening for me because you didn't get to see those dynamics. But I will say what's interesting about it is that, like, the incoming black kids very much became the uniting factor for, like, I mean, it was a great microcosm about how this country works.
Right.
Sounds, you know, like what I mean? It. If you introduce black people to that context, it's like, oh, okay, the white delegation can now rest in their civil war and agree on, yeah, we can agree on who we don't like now. You know what I mean?
Right. That's tribalism.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the same way Trump got elected. You know what I mean? It's the exact same. You see, I mean, like, high school is that time where you get to see, like, people start making deals. You know what I mean? I'm like, you guys hated each other, like, you know, maybe sophomore year, but by junior year, your families have formed an alliance, you know?
Right. I've heard that about the prison system. Like, once you go in, you have to decide who your tribe is.
Yeah.
So if you're a white guy, you just have to be a white supremacist.
Yeah.
Or else you get your ass kicked and let you convert to Orthodox or something. I don't even...
Yeah, they say, yeah, like, for a guy like me, it's like, I have to, like, join... I have to become a Muslim, actually, like a black Muslim.
Right. Because
that's the only guy that gets to read in prison without being, like, victimized.
Really? Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to read books, you have to become a black nationalist. Yeah. So that's been interesting because, in prisons, they've expanded, like, so what white nationalism means. So, like Irish guys get to join the Aryans, and, like, they've seen, like, some Jews have joined the Aryans if they went in, right?
Which doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any sense. And they ask, well, Catholics and Jews are your party organization. It's like, it's just they're white numbers aren't big enough to where they can be exclusive.
Right.
So even the Aryans are like, we have to be more inclusive in our whiteness in order to compete with the Latinos or whatever.
We'll take gays and Jews now. We're fine. It's okay.
Yeah. You know, everybody makes deals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People say one thing and then they'll do another thing. It's like the same thing. You know, you'll see it. I mean, I think you're seeing it with some segments of the Latino community. Like, I mean, people are shocked. You know, Trump got 30% of the Latino vote. They got more of the Latino vote than Romney did.
It's amazing to me.
It's not if you... So, yes, it's amazing, but this is why it was great living in Texas, right? Because you get to see the span of Mexicanness.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's like white...
With the cowboys.
There's that. There's like... So there's brand new Mexican, and then there's like Anglo-Mexican family that's been in the country 200 years landowning.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like...
That might have voted for Trump.
They might have voted for Trump. Yeah. They, like, you know... I mean, he's not Mexican, but, I mean, you see Ted Cruz like guys,
right,
in the Mexican community, right, in the elite end, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Marco Rubio,
they are the Cubans, you know, the Cubans and the, you know, your Florida Cubans, you know. So, like, you know, that was kind of a revealing thing too, because it was like a doubt, and, you know, in Texas, that, you know, being, you know, Latino was like also a big thing, you know. It's like, you know, your campus, your high school experience in Texas is more divided into like 3 to 4 groups.
So moving to this, I want to talk about moving to Dallas and back and forth, like you said. But how did this change you? I mean, you saw the different spectrums of white people, but then you also saw the different spectrums of how people adapted.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting thing, man. Like, it's like, I don't know. I think it reinforced where I want to live very much. Like, I'm very much an urban person. Like, I didn't really realize how much the things that I value in a place to live are city based, because I'm very much into.
What is it about the city? The diversity?
Yeah. And it's also, there's not a culture of assimilation. So the suburbs have their diversity, but it's very much a culture of like assimilation there. And it's like, no, I want to know what's actually cool about your people.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, the suburbs is where you could take anybody from the world and you could turn them into a nice white picket fence, middle class consumer. But it's like, I want to go to your, whatever experience you were running away from, I want to actually go see that. I want to go see your shop downtown. I want to go see, what things have you brought to this country? You know what I mean? That's the stuff I want to see. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
Anybody can do whatever they want. I don't want to essentialize people and tell you how to live your life, but I'm just saying it's more interesting to me to interact with different cultures and stuff like that more on their own terms. You know what I mean?
Is that why you like touring around places like South Carolina?
Hell yeah. Because all those places, I mean, like, even when you go to a place like South Carolina because of the economy, like, there's all these, like, insane things like, oh, like, just a ton of Eastern Europeans there.
Really?
They brought in all these Eastern Europeans to like, as, like, sort of, like, a labor force year-round. Like, I'm talking about, like, Myrtle Beach and places like this.
Yeah. Seasonal work?
No, they're permanent. I mean, because the people are starting, you know, place... South Carolina on paper is like this. It's like the American dream, right? It's like a place with like a booming economy, but in like no taxes.
Okay.
So people are going there to participate in like this like beach economy that is like, but now it's grown enough with the retiree community and things like that to where it's become like, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people living in this place now. So they're building up all this infrastructure for all this stuff, you know.
So there's industry for people to earn a living.
Yeah. You know, it's a beach. Okay. I own the beach store. You know what I mean? I sell the towels and the t-shirts with the, you know, female body inspector, FBI, you know, all that stuff you find on any boardwalk. Yeah.
Like, I got crabs in Myrtle Beach.
Yeah. All that stuff. Yeah. It's like somebody from like Lithuania.
Yeah.
Or it's like, hey, I moved here to sell this stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, but that's more, what's happening in Myrtle Beach is more of kind of an assimilationist thing, too.
Right, right.
But it's, I don't know, America's a weird country, because you could be like, I think you people voted for Trump, but they're also very much like, the first thing they'll brag about is, yeah, a lot of immigrants come down here. It's real cool, you know? They come down here to work in the economy.
Exactly, and they'll love their culture, they'll love their food, but then vote against their interests.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what's so crazy. I mean, when you see like anti-Mexican sentiment in Texas, especially parts of Texas, when it's like these people, like there are white people that have taken on so many aspects of Mexican culture as their own culture.
Absolutely.
And they don't even like, you know, it's like, dude, you literally are like eating a breakfast burrito every day.
Yeah.
And you're like, I want them out of here. I'm like, but no, you don't.
I think that might be the difference between the concept of immigration and actually meeting a human person that's an immigrant.
Yeah. Well, it's also upward mobility. So when you see somebody that comes to the country and they're doing a little bit better than you, maybe, or they're doing the same as you, or they're, you know, you don't feel superior to them, then it's like you want them to go, right?
Right.
Yeah. Everyone's okay with immigrants as a servant class, but when they start owning things and they start winning, like maybe positioning themselves to maybe influence politicians and win an election, that's when you get these, we want them out of here.
Right, because maybe it makes them reflect on themselves and say, wow, I've been here longer and I'm not doing as well. What's up with that?
Yeah, but rather than just be like, and nobody ever blames the system. That's what's so great. They always find like, it's always just find a lower person on the totem pole. It's like, dude, the banks just foreclosed your house. It's like, that's not a Mexican dude's fault.
Yeah, but there's automation taking over all the jobs or new technologies.
Yeah, no one will ever blame any of those things, right? It's always go after a specific group of people, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So your parents divorced at what age?
Six.
Six.
Yeah.
Okay, and your dad moved from Missouri to Dallas?
No, he'd actually been in Dallas since 79. So I was born in Kansas City, but it's been like, you know, a lot of my early childhood was in Dallas.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know.
In Dallas, the city of Dallas?
Plano, Texas.
Plano, yeah.
Which is right, yeah. Which at the time, there wasn't that many people there. Now, Plano's probably 200,000 people, 100,000. You know, it's huge. Like,
yeah,
Plano's a huge place, yeah. But there weren't that many people out there. It was pre black tar heroin Plano.
Okay. Has that affected?
For kids my age, that was a big thing. The kids were dying from the black tar heroin. It was in the news. You know what I mean? But that was like right as I moved to Kansas City, where it was like, we'll get you out of heroin territory. We'll get you into crack territory.
Was that a conscious move your mom made?
No, it was just what was, I mean, it was the reflection of who was doing the drugs. Yeah, you know, it's like poor black neighborhood is crack. It was like rich white kids in Plano are dying of heroin overdoses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they thought crack would be better for you than the...
No, I had to get out of Dallas. My dad was insane, man. Like, and I just had to get out of there, you know. So we just like, it was like, mom, come get us. Yeah.
Why did you have to get out of there?
Oh, my dad's crazy. Like, he's like, and I don't mean crazy in the way that like stigmatize like actual mental health. Like, he's just like not... He's just not like all there, like a lot of bad decisions and things like that.
Yeah. Is there a one particular bad decision that stands out?
Oh, the constant jeopardizing of our living situation, like is like always uncertain whether like we would live in a place, like have a place to live.
Oh.
So yeah, like that, yeah, that was one of those things. And it would be like just personal choices. Like, I didn't like what my boss said today, so I quit. It's like, well, you have kids.
Right. How old was he when he was raising you?
How old was he?
Yeah.
I mean, he's like 60 now. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, old enough to know better. But
he wasn't like 19 years old.
No. It wasn't like, yeah, he wasn't a teenager when right. he had us or anything like that. Yeah. So, yeah. So you just had to get out of there. You know, you do your eighth motel in Mesquite, Texas.
Oh, really?
Time was, at like a motel or something. You know what I mean?
He was like, doing that shuffling. You have brother or sister?
I have a little brother. Yeah. Okay. I have an older brother too. But my older brother ran away from home at 16 to get away from my dad. And it was like, so that was the irony. We all ended up running away from home.
You did?
All three of us. We all ran away.
You ran away?
Yeah. We told our mom to just come get us. We didn't tell him she was coming to get us.
Oh, so she just came and swooped
you up. Just came to get us, which is very illegal now that I work at a school.
Yes.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Like kidnapping. So but but it had to be done. And if it would have went to, it couldn't have never, I mean, if it had went through the process, we'd have gotten taken out of there too.
If it would have went through the legal process.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you don't have a place for your kids to live. I mean, we've been in crazy places like Mesquite, Texas, like, you know, like truckers knocking on the door, like, you want me to watch some kids? It's like, what the fuck? You know what I mean?
Wow.
Like, shit where you reflect on it, where it's like, I'm pretty sure it was like lot lizards around and stuff like that.
Right.
Things you don't really think about when you're a kid, but you're like, oh, that was a truck stop prostitute that was at the ice machine all the time.
Yeah, and you could only be grateful that you didn't realize the magnitude of what was going on when you were a kid.
Yeah, and you don't have any sense. I knew I was poor, though, because it was always the insistence on keeping us in good schools. Like the kid in the motel that goes to, it's like, can we move to the hood where at least some other people are experiencing hardship?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So why weren't you with your mom in the first place?
Well, because there was this idea that men should raise boys.
Oh.
So it's part of that, you know, that thing that we don't believe in that much anymore.
Yeah. I never heard that.
That was a prevailing thing. Well, because it was contextual. You know, it was like a lot of kids that didn't have dads were getting shot during that period. Like, you understand it in the, you know, it's kind of like the boys in the hood narrative.
Yeah.
It's like boys should be with their father.
Them tough.
Yeah. But that's actually kind of like not what happened there. That's an irony. It's like,
yeah, because it's probably, stereotypically, it could be less of a nurturing environment.
Well, yeah, it's not even that. It's just that also, too, we'd have tough living situations, but you were always put in really good schools. So that didn't really make you tough. It actually gave you like profound insecurities.
Well, when you were living in hotels, was your dad leaving you there and going to work?
I mean, sometimes, yeah. Uh-huh. And then,
How old were you when this was happening?
Man, all the way from, I mean, I say anyway from the age of like 10 to 14. Like that whole period was like.
You know. And you had a little brother.
Yeah.
So did you feel a sense of responsibility?
Yeah. And we got along fine. I mean, and we got along in all the places we were, we assimilated fine. It's just by the time you had assimilated to them, you were getting moved somewhere else. That was the issue.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you realize that it was ungrounding at the time? I mean, I'm sure you felt it.
A little bit, because you make friends and stuff like that. And then you go to a different school and then you lose contact with your friends and stuff like that.
Right.
But it was easy to doubt. That's why I got into comedy, because it was like, it was the easiest way to make friends.
Yeah. You develop a sense of humor and you realize this works wherever I go.
Yeah.
How many times did you move schools? Did you ever count?
It's double digits.
Double digits. Wow.
Yeah.
From?
I went to double digit numbers of schools, I'd say, yeah.
What's the longest you were in a school?
The shortest, I know the shortest. I think I went to one school for like 4 months.
Four months, wow.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I talk about sometimes 2 to 3 schools a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel like that affected your education?
Yeah, I mean, I can't do any math.
Really?
Like anything to where it's built a base to where you learn through, I can't do any math at all.
Right.
But that's the only way I've noticed it. Like math and science, but I can read. I'm very good at reading.
Yeah.
But I can't do math and science are just lost on me.
Well, good thing we have calculators now, you know.
Yeah.
Right on our phones.
Yeah. Yeah. But other things, I went to good enough schools to where I learned good skills, you know, for like reading, writing, and like critical thinking and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, that's interesting that your parents always want to keep you in a better school. I mean, trying to send you to private school, that says something.
Yeah, so they would put me in the, and then if I went to urban schools, they would put me in the gifted program. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if I was that gifted. I think it was just, I think maybe I had a, like, my parents would put a sweater on me or something. And they're like, well, he must go in the gifted program.
Well, you probably took an IQ test.
It's true.
Maybe you took several IQ tests moving schools.
yeah, I took one. So yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it was cool.
Do you know if you scored high on it? I imagine you did.
I think I did, but I don't remember what the score was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they put me in the talented and gifted program, which is weird. But it's interesting. I don't really know enough about how they measure these things and like. Whether it was just being eccentric, and then it was also maybe having an imagination too. Like, if you have an imagination, like maybe that says something about your.
Yeah, maybe they could measure that in an IQ test somehow.
Maybe that helps. Just having an imagination, but you had to have one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you think that was the big formative experience, moving from the inner city to the suburb.
Yeah.
But all these different schools. And the hotels and different homes.
But it was all the same dynamic, though, because in Dallas, you know, with the busing dynamic, you were still caught between... The Dallas was where you'd put all those people in the same context. That was what was interesting about that.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
So all these different people are going to the same place?
They're all going to the same school in Dallas.
Right.
And that was what was, like, was wild about it, you know what I mean? Like, and it was good, but it was also, like, it was, you know, it was like an intense kind of atmosphere in its own way.
How so?
Just because, you know, like you have really affluent white people that are like in the Plano sort of Richardson area. You have like bust in black kids. You have like middle class black kids that are trying to figure out, they might live in Richardson and Plano. They're trying to figure out how do they racially fit into this thing.
Right.
Are they hanging with the inner city kids? Are they hanging with the white kids that they've grown up with their entire lives?
Right.
You had like black kids from the inner city who are being bussed in, who are coming from tough neighborhoods to where they're like, they're still in gangs, right? They're like there's fights all the time at school. There are guns at school, right? But then there's like, also these kids are being shipped into these places and it's Texas. So these kids are a lot of times from the rough neighborhoods are the basis of like these big athletic programs. Like, okay. Yeah. So it's like, I mean, like I got like, there was recruiting for high school football. They're like going into junior high, telling you to keep your grades up and start lifting.
Wow.
Yeah. Cause when people say Friday Night Lights, that's not fake, man.
Yeah. What is Friday Night Lights?
Friday Night Lights is a movie/television show about high school football in Texas. You know, kids in high school and, you know, in big high schools in Texas are playing high school football games in front of 10,000 people on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So if you turn it into like the Big 12 network, they just show high school football on the Big 12 network when college football isn't playing.
Right.
So you have kids so the high school quarterback coming out of a Texas high school has actually ran a pro style spread offense.
Right.
He's already ran those things.
To think about your experience in dealing with all these different people, if I zoom out, I'm like, this is really all about identity.
Yeah.
You know, because we're all kind of, especially growing up at that formative age, we're trying to figure out who we are. And we only figure out who we are in relation to other people.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard this? That when people are put in solitary confinement, they go completely insane and they consider it a form of torture.
Yeah.
Because you have you're nothing without being reflected off somebody else.
Oh, yeah.
You just wither away into like this amorphous, selfless blob. Without another person in front of you to reflect, so you can see your reflection off of someone else.
Yeah, it's weird. A lot of times I felt like a man without a country, but in a way that helps because you stand out.
You stand out with other people, but But who are you? You're trying to figure out who you are.
I'm go to therapy after this, so I'm
after this podcast.
Yeah, literally after this podcast, I'm going straight to therapy.
Nice,
but it's not like the first time I've gone. I've been gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've never reflected on these things until like 3 months ago.
Really? Yeah, did you just start therapy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's so good, right?
It's very nice.
Yeah, I find therapy's really good before the podcast because you're already talking, you're in the zone.
I don't even like to talk that much sometimes, though.
At therapy?
Yeah, which just makes it a little weird. I just like to listen to what people are saying and stuff like that.
But wait, that's what your therapist is supposed to be doing. Are you invoicing them?
No, yeah, no, but...
you're paying for it. You guys talk.
It's couples therapy.
Oh, it's couples therapy.
Yeah, so all the way these things influence my private relationships.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you always go with your girlfriend?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I like to hear what everybody's saying. I like it's interesting to me to hear about what I do from someone else. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I did that.
What? Have you been to therapy on your own?
No. No.
Does the couples therapy session turn into just a therapy session with you?
No, not really. I mean, I just like to listen sometimes. But I talk a lot, but I also sometimes I like to listen.
Yeah.
Because this is revealing for me, you know, like just hearing. Because I don't necessarily think about what I'm doing at all times. I just do stuff. I'm a busy man. So I'm just doing things all the time. And so I don't get to hear about the way my behavior may impact other people in a private context. Or think about the rationale of why I do so much stuff, mm-hmm. too, is very interesting.
What is the rationale?
I don't know, man. I think part of it's hard working. Part of it's like I enjoy people. And then part of it is like... like I feel like a sort of like I feel like obligations towards people, like in a lot of ways. That's what I think.
Like responsible for people?
Yeah, or responsible to them. Like I would always want to do right by people. So that means I sign up for a lot of things, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that happens being an older brother.
Yeah.
You grow up having to care for someone that's younger than you and that person's looking up to you usually.
Yeah. Like I feel responsibilities towards people, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good, but you also have to feel a responsibility to yourself, which is a common theme in therapy.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think about it. But yeah, so my entire life is sort of structured towards others in a lot of ways, which is really interesting. Like, yeah, like all this work and stuff like that.
Like you're not thinking about yourself; you're being concerned about that person and this person,
or just I'll do it with no consideration of like. Well, is that possible? So, yeah, like at my day job a lot, this has been thing like, you know, like I'm like serving on a lot of stuff because I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. And because I feel an obligation towards the organization. I want to make it work and things like that. But the idea of pushing back is like not one that I would have.
Right. Well, there's a couple of things here. I mean, are you being busy just so you don't have to reflect on things?
No, I'm not running from anything.
Right.
No, it's actually the more doing stuff gets me out of the house.
Right, but being in the house is where you do a lot of reflection.
I like being in the house, but you can't be in the house too long. I like being in the house so much that I have to get out.
Yeah.
Because I could just plant flowers all day and be like perfect.
Yeah.
But now they bring food to you.
What is your day job?
I'm a history professor at the City College of New York.
Oh, wow. So you teach college level
kids. Yeah.
Wow. History, huh?
Yeah.
That's impressive. You're a professor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still can't add, though.
You don't need to.
I don't need to. Yeah.
So do you see any of yourself in your students?
Yeah. I mean, access to higher education, like college. I was the first person in my family to graduate from college, so it changed my life. So mm-hmm. I teach a city college, so that's my students.
Right.
My students came, you know, children of immigrants, you know, to, you know, fourth, fifth generation kids from Harlem and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, like, you know, it's all the things that I see. I mean, my context is different from them because they're all native New Yorkers.
Right. They grew up with more diversity.
They grew up with more diversity and they're New York sort of exposes you to a lot of things, but also shelters you from so much stuff. So like the rest of the country is just a complete mystery to a 20-year-old that grew up in New York City.
Yeah, I noticed because I've lived in a few different places, and I noticed that about New Yorkers. They kind of think they have seen it all and done it all because you feel like that here. It's a big metropolis, but you don't see a lot of different areas of the country where it's not urban at all.
Yeah, well, even that, or they don't even get a sense about other cities. Like, that's, I mean, that's sort of the, and then in the gentrification moment, it's like all the things that I find that even like for newer people that have moved here, a lot of people are moving to New York City to find something that actually exists. They're moving to a moment that actually has passed here.
Right. It doesn't exist
anymore. It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
The person
about.
That's trying to get in on the edgy Bedford stop of the L.
Right.
That's gone, man. That's been gone for, you know, for a few years now.
Yeah.
But it's like a city like Detroit is where that's actually happening.
Exactly. I mean, New York City, you don't see any prostitutes on the corners. You barely see graffiti. You barely see drug dealers.
No, it's like clean. It's like, it's safe. It's nice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
it's barely even a city.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's Epcot Center.
Yeah. That's what, I mean, that's what's so funny, because it's like all the things that people glamorize about like New York City, as far as on the bad end that they glamorize it, that's what the city of Newark is. But Newark gets blasted for it.
Yeah,
like it's like Newark, oh my god, there's all this thing and all those things, but then like someone moves here in New York, like, you know, hoping for like some of that edginess.
I saw Warriors on TV. I want to go to New York.
Exactly. But it's like, you're not gonna see any Warriors.
No.
Yeah,
they all moved to Newark.
They all moved to Newark, baby. And even they're getting pushed out there. But even like, but even like Newark, where it's like, if you want to go to like a warehouse party and stuff like that, it's like where I go out in New York, like, do your listeners know where you live?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it's actually coming out.
They don't,
like,
know my address. Don't say my address.
It's actually like, now I'm coming out here to hang out now. That's right. How I know, like, the things that I'm interested in are actually like in your neighborhood now. Like, yeah. It's not in the time out, not out in New York. Cause whatever's in there has passed. Like, I saw on Twitter, it was like Union Pool was trending. I'm like, what is this? 15 years ago?
Right. Exactly.
You know what I mean? I'm like, but like, to do something edgy, you gotta be like in Newark, or you gotta be in Ridgewood. You gotta be in all those places to go to a place where like a creative non-corporate thing that people that don't have a bunch of money are making it happen.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of places. And there's like so many cities in the country now. And New Yorkers don't realize how much, like, I mean, maybe they're starting to realize it. Like, you go off on the Bedford stop at the L, it's like the corporate creep is real, man. Like,
oh yeah, Whole Foods, Apple Store. It's not the Brooklyn you would think.
No, it's like, I mean, and like people calling the police because of noise.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You move to Brooklyn above a music venue and you're complaining about noise.
Yeah, and like the music venue gets shut down, right?
Exactly.
Or like the full restaurants that can't possibly pay their rent. It's a weird thing. It's a balance. In Newark, we're like, we are glad that Whole Foods is there. This building was on fire for 50 years, but it's like Whole Foods doesn't control anything. Like it's just a place where people can now buy fresh food without having to leave the entire city, which is what they had to do for like the last 40 years.
Yeah, but you also lose the individualism of the place. I mean, you go into a Whole Foods, you could be anywhere. You could be in any Whole Foods.
It's true. It's a majority minority Whole Foods though, which does make it a little bit. It's like the Harlem Whole Foods.
Is it?
Yeah. It's like the 125th Street Whole Foods.
I got to go check that out.
Yeah.
That's the new New York. I'm going up to Harlem to check out the Whole Foods there.
But it's the same people that are there. That's what I say. What is gentrification in Newark going to look like? It's going to look like the way gentrification in Harlem looked. It's going to be like a black version. Like, it's like Marcus Samuelson is on 125th Street. He's also in downtown Newark now.
Do you feel a Newark pride?
Yeah, I like that city. I root for it. I mean, it's a post-industrial working class, like radically black liberal city, you know what I mean? Like, you can't help, and also if you study the history and you get a sense of what has been done to that place, like, it gets collectively punished for being what it is.
It is the butt of some jokes.
Oh my god, all the time. Yeah. But I don't even really worry about those jokes though, because it's like my house goes up $5,000 a month in value,
right?
And it's like Newark is like making fun of Newark now. You can't really make fun of Newark, especially because depending on where you live in New York City, you might live in the Newark of New York City.
You own your house.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, because it just didn't make it. I mean, it was like, why would you be in a luxury apartment in a city where the houses were going for $150,000?
Right.
In the New York City metropolitan area.
Your mortgage is probably less than my rent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No joke about that. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting, because you grew up being shuffled around hotels, and you're still young. You're still a young guy. Yeah. You know, you own your own home now.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, it's all ironies of the economy, right? It's my, you know, they got me in those suburban schools to get me out of the hood, and the first thing I did was buy a house right back in the hood again.
How long ago did you buy it?
2 years ago.
Okay.
And but I'm not downtown though. I can't afford to, like, that's where the speculators are. And then like the eastern end of the city, the Ironbound, that's where they are, because that's the all the places where it's close to the train station.
Right.
I'm a little bit north of town, which is basically, I live in Spanish Harlem with houses.
Okay. But I mean, all of New York is getting, I don't know about gentrified, but yeah, it's all going up in value.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because there's nowhere to go. Like, it's nowhere to go. I mean, the fact, just the presence of New Yorkers in, like, Newark gives you a sense it's like there is literally nowhere else to go.
You feel that happening?
Yeah. I mean, you see, that's been happening long before I got there, because it's like, you know, it's only 20 minutes into Manhattan.
Right.
So that makes it a better commute than a lot of places. So
what happened to your mom and dad?
Okay, so my dad still lives in Dallas. He's still wild. I don't talk to him.
You don't talk to him?
I don't talk to him at all.
When's the last time you spoke to him?
I don't remember. Maybe 2 years ago, something like that.
Was this your decision?
No, he disowned me via text message. He always, like, does and says mean things. And I'm like, this time I'll just take you up on it. Like, I was actually very accommodating toward him. Like, I'd always be like, oh, come help him and stuff like that. Then one time I was like, nah, I think I'll just accept your word on this one.
So did you feel like you were the parent?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, he was making you the adult.
Yeah, you have to be the adult in the room, yeah.
Right, it was up to you to make this situation right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's incapable of those kinds of things, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and my mom, she's great. She lives in Kansas City, you know, like, she's like, you know, pretty high up at Verizon and things like that, so it's been great.
You mean like she has like a really good data plan, or she works for Verizon?
She works for Verizon, okay. Yeah.
She's got that 10 gigabyte data plan, super high up.
Yeah, so, you know, in that sense, it's good, you know.
She must be proud of you.
Yeah, it's good. We had to deliver on the investment, so it's where, you know, me and my little brother were proud, you know what I mean? Because
mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of people went through a lot of great lengths to make sure that we succeeded, and so, you know, we're trying to, like, you know, give return on that investment.
When your little brother, you said your little brother ran away when he was 16?
My older brother did.
Your older brother when he was 16?
Yeah.
Did you ever find him?
I found it. Yeah, we found it. So he has a different mom. So his mom is kind of grounded in like Kansas City, Kansas, which is like, you know, like during that area, it's a tough place. You know what I mean?
You talk to him?
I do talk to him. I see him all the time. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, he's good. You know, he's got, you know, got kids and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So
does he talk to your dad?
No, none of us do.
None of you talk
There's
to
nothing your dad. You can do. There's nothing you can do.
See a boozer or something?
Kind of, but it's not really even from that perspective. He's just, you know.
Is he just like a overgrown kid or just?
Yeah, I think he quit developing. His dad died when he was 17 of a heart attack.
Yeah.
So I don't think he ever grew past that emotionally.
Right. And one thing I've heard about and I've seen with family members, like having kids, you kind of, if you have children, you relive your childhood through your kid.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe him raising three boys, he's seeing himself in all these different phases, and it's just too much.
Yeah, yeah.
He needed the couples therapy.
He needs a lot of therapy. He needs a lot of therapy for sure.
Yeah, sounds like your formative experiences did you well.
Yeah, I'm happy with who I everything's good, man.
Yeah. When's your next stand-up show?
Just go to justinwilliamscomedy.com.
Mm-hmm.
All my shows are listed there.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing.
Dude, thank you so much. It's good to see you, man. And also, I want to talk to you more because you have a lot of insight into people.
Oh,
maybe
thank
you can help
you.
Me out.
Yeah. I part of me wants to be a therapist.
I think you'd be a good one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I get that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
That's cool. All right. We'll talk about that.
right.
How much is your current therapist? I'll undercut them.
Oh, it's part of my insurance.
So oh, it is. Yeah. I got to get on that insurance thing. All right. Yeah. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.